George F. Kennan was the greatest diplomat of the Cold War and one of America's best of all time. The Russian soul, as he saw it, was more than the Soviet Union and would outlast it. From the studios of the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., welcome to this discussion with Professor John Lewis Gaddis, whose book George F. Kennan, An American Life, published by the Penguin Press, is one of 10 longlisted for the 2012 Lionel Gelber Prize as top English language foreign affairs book of the year, named in memory of Canadian diplomat Lionel Gelber. The Gelber Prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, and Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School Fellowships in Global Journalism at the University of Toronto. Kennan was more than just a diplomat. Yale's professor John Lewis Gaddis, one of the greatest historians of the Cold War, in his new biography reveals Kennan as a writer, a poet, a historian, and a teacher, a philosopher, in fact, of global power, and a somewhat tortured one at that. When a great historian of the Cold War writes the life of the best diplomat of the Cold War, the result is something very special. Professor Gaddis, welcome.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
There's a great story behind this book, actually. You've been working on it for 30 years, and you've written 9 other books, so it's not that it takes you 30 years to write a book. Tell us how this book actually came to be.
Well, the book really was the result of my third book, which was Strategies of Containment, written at a time when I was still a very junior academic. But Kennan read it and liked it. And I started getting fan mail from him, which led me to wonder if he was angling for a biography. But I finally ventured to ask him, and he wrote back and said, well, it had never occurred to him that anybody would want to write his biography. But now that I mentioned it, we should talk about it. And so we did, and that's how the deal was made, with the understanding that it would be a posthumous biography, which he would never read.
Was that your condition or his condition?
Both of us wanted it that way. George was a historian as well as a diplomat, and he understood that biographies really can't be any good if the subject of the biography is looking over the shoulder of the biographer. It just doesn't work.
Was he ever tempted to take a look at your notes, just even ask you your impressions? Like, how does this story of my life actually sound to you?
No. Well, he may have been tempted, but if he was tempted, he never showed this to me. The one time in the entire history of the project that he asked to see anything from it was on the occasion of his 100th birthday.
100th.
Remember, he was 78 when we made this deal in 1981. This would have been in 2004. And I was doing a talk at the centennial celebrations of his birthday at Princeton. And I saw him that morning, and he asked if he could see a copy of what I was going to say. And I said, sure. But then he said, but don't show it to me if you think it will compromise the integrity of the biography.
Wow. This actually speaks to sort of the qualities of patience and integrity that seem to really characterize his diplomatic career.
Well, I think it is. I think it does. And the way it wound up, I think maybe he saw one sentence of what is really a 700-page book.
Hmm. And at one point, people started to joke that he might outlast you. The book might never actually get written.
Well, these are my students who joke all the time, but they do have kind of a weird sense of humor. But we were both beginning to wonder about this because George was 78 when we made the deal. We thought that probably in the natural course of events, you know, he would last for another 5 to 10 years or so, and then the book would come out shortly thereafter. So it did surprise us both that he lived as long as he did. And what was particularly interesting for me was to get frequent apologies from George Kennan for surviving and therefore delaying the book.
Let's get into a little bit of what made him stand out as a diplomat. You made your connection around your book on containment. That's the very, very broadly, very simply, that's the idea, as a lot of us understand it, that particularly under President Truman, the United States would set out to check the Soviet Union anywhere it or its allies tried to expand in the world. But as I understand from reading the book, Ambassador Kennan actually didn't like it when he was too closely identified with what a lot of people thought as the containment doctrine.
Well, that's how Truman phrased it in the Truman Doctrine speech in 1947. But Kennan, who was developing his ideas at this time, really had a more sophisticated idea in mind. The idea was that, first of all, we wanted to avoid the two really bad extremes, which would have been war with the Soviet Union or appeasement of the Soviet Union. But he said the last thing we should do is try to oppose Soviet influence or communist ideology everywhere in the world that it appears, because we don't have the resources to do that. We would spread ourselves too thin. And so Kennan really favored focusing just on a few strong points, like Western Europe and Japan, concentrating on that. And at the same time that Truman is saying we're going to contain communism everywhere, Kennan is saying we're going to let China fall to the communists, because it's not a vital center of power, and it would take it would be too much trouble to defend it.
So that great parlor game of the 1950s and 1960s around Washington, who lost China? It was Kennan.
In some ways, that's accurate, because Kennan simply said, we can't do that. But he also said something else about China, which was very interesting, in 1947. This is 2 years before the communists take over. He said, if the communists take over, or when the communists take over, they will not be satellites of the Soviet Union, that they will be more Chinese nationalists than they will be Chinese communists, and that in due course, there will be a significant split between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. That's 1947.
So
that's a pretty good prediction.
So this is one of the amazing things that comes out over and over again in reading this book, is that he has a remarkable degree of prescience. I mean, I sort of went into this thinking, okay, Kennan was a strategist who knew Russia particularly well. Mm-hmm. But really, it seems like it's more than that. He had his skills were a little deeper. It was almost like he was a novelist, a poet, a writer who knew human beings very well and happened to have been a diplomat.
Well, I think that's right. He believed deeply in national character. And the way that you understand national character, he believed, was through as much the study of literature as the study of history. And so that was very important for him in trying to understand the Russian national character. And what he said is that national character is not easily changed. Ideology is, it looks impressive on the surface, but it really is unlikely to shift national character. So he said that about the Russians, but I think he also understood this about the Chinese.
Did he understand America as well as he understood the Russians?
No, paradoxically, I think he understood America really quite badly. Frequently was making strange pronouncements, writing strange things. He certainly was an elitist. He never understood American politics. He was intensely frustrated when the normal constitutional procedures of congressional review of foreign policy would interfere with foreign policy. But it's a great paradox that somebody who understood the Soviet Union as well as he did understood the United States as badly.
Well, and in fact, the paradox almost seems even deeper than that. That you know, for someone who's basically in the daily business of protecting democracy, he wasn't too much of a Democrat himself. I mean, this whole idea of elitism, that puts it nicely. I mean, there some of his writings, very personal writings, which he never really intended to have out there, really even question whether some people should be involved in government, some people should even have the vote.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think maybe the best way to think about this is that the America he was trying to protect was the America of his youth, say the turn of the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, which was a very different place from what the country was in the middle of the 20th century. He had a great nostalgia for that earlier America in which he had spent his boyhood.
Suburban Milwaukee,
yeah,
Wisconsin.
Milwaukee, yeah, Wisconsin itself. And that's what he was nostalgic for, and that's what he was trying to protect. But he simply did not understand the evolution of the country. And that's partly because he spent so much time out of the country as a Foreign Service officer.
Hmm. He wanted, in terms of American policy, he wanted America to have a sort of a grand strategy where economic policy, trade policy, military policy, intelligence, and foreign policy were all sort of woven together, right? Other countries he saw sort of had that. America didn't have that. Did he make any headway on that? Do we have any headway on that now?
He certainly did feel that way. He felt strongly about that. And he was actually given the responsibility by General Marshall, when Marshall became Secretary of State in 1947, of devising a grand strategy for the United States. He was the first head of the State Department's policy planning staff. And the papers that he produced on this are really quite amazing. And in the broadest sense, saying that we could contain the Soviet Union, that its own internal contradictions would cause it to fall apart in due course.
It's almost Marxist.
In a broad sense, he was right. Hmm. And we did have that grand strategy, indeed, and we sustained it over some 4.5 decades. Hmm. But along the way, there were so many departures from that basic idea, particularly increased emphasis on military defense. He opposed the formation of NATO, for example. He was horrified by the nuclear arms race. The things we had to do to execute the strategy of containment really convinced him that we had corrupted the strategy of containment. Hmm. I think that's wrong. That's how he felt.
He was a bit of a he's a bit of a tortured soul, wasn't he?
He was an enormously tortured soul. And I think much of this goes back probably to the loss of his mother when he was only 2 months old, to growing up without a mother, to a permanent sense of loneliness, never really completely feeling comfortable anywhere. And then he combined this with the qualities of a great writer, and particularly a great diarist. The diary itself runs into thousands of pages. And so much of this is recorded in far greater detail than what you would expect to find in most people, certainly in most professional diplomats.
And none of that's been published, huh?
Only portions have been published.
And his poetry hasn't been published?
Mostly not. In his memoirs and in a couple of other short books that he did, he quoted from a few of the poems and some of the diary entries. But most of it has not been published. And, of course, I was only able to scratch the surface of it in my big book.
So if I'll just wrap it up with this, that this actually, I think, if one could get a hold of them and had the rights to them, and if it were practicable, I think a book of George Kennan's poetry would not only be inspiring but really illuminating to Foreign Service officers and people anywhere who are working in global affairs. There are beautiful passages in your book, Professor, about him sitting on the DC-3s crossing the Atlantic in World War II, writing poetry. And a lot of that was actually really great. So thank you very much, John Lewis Gaddis, for talking with us about your book, George F. Kennan, An American Life, published by the Penguin Press. You can hear more interviews with authors longlisted for the Lionel Gelber Prize, including Henry Kissinger, Neil Ferguson, Amanda Foreman, Francis Fukuyama, Frederick Kempe, Peter Thompson, Ezra Fogel, Sean McMeekin, and Mustafa Akyol. You can find them all at www.utoronto.ca/monk. That's MUNK/Gelber, GELBER. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School Fellowships in Global Journalism at the University of Toronto. Thank you for joining us.